I'm speaking with Dr. Leslie, L-E-S-L-I-E, Ford.
Right.
On December 17th, 2008, and I have your permission to record the call?
Yes.
Thank you. Tell me, how does a math major come into cancer prevention?
So I was a math major in undergraduate and then went to medical school because my mother told me I had two choices, to either do something in math and or science, and never liked seeing patients, never liked practicing. Through a couple of serendipitous events, wound up doing my last 3 months of medical school as an intern in what was, this was back in the middle 70s, in what was originally called the Bureau of Quality Assurance. It was the last generation of the, as they say, the best and the brightest during the, it was actually even before Califano came to the department, when somebody had, it was soon after Medicare, where somebody had the bright idea that Medicare should only pay for care that was of high quality and reasonable and necessary. And there was a unit set up called the Professional Standards Review Organizations. It was the legislation to set up organizations around the country that would be charged with reviewing the necessity and quality of care before Medicare would pay. So it's kind of a, when people talk about quality assurance now and quality care, it really had its roots in the 70s, but people don't read history. Anyway.
Breaking my heart.
Yeah, right. We had a big contract with the AMA to develop criteria for what was reasonable and necessary and high quality, and I kind of fell into that group worked my way up to be the associate director for quality assurance. Then I went over to the HMO program, also when that became a federal mandate that HMOs be one of the plans offered, and was the director of quality assurance for the HMO program. To make a long story short, that was when Reagan was around and there was a lot of downsizing, and they decided that the HMO program only needed administrators and not physicians or medical input, and I wound up RIFT, or about to be, and met Jerry Yates, who I'm sure his name has come up. When it was just when Peter was starting the division, he had just been brought in. Jerry was going to be the director of community oncology and outreach, and they were looking for somebody that had some knowledge of quality assurance and how you get physicians to practice the best medicine that we know is available and how you evaluate and measure the outcomes. And so I was hired.
And
originally as the evaluation specialist for the community programs.
And
it was way before CCOP or, you know.
Right. And what was the, were they specifically looking for someone to develop this?
Well, they were specifically looking for someone to develop the evaluation. It
right.
was pretty unique if you think way back when. Now we always talk about any new program has to have metrics and all. Well, this was back in 1982 when Peter and Jerry Yates had the foresight to know that any, you know, this was pretty sweeping to talk about community oncology, to say that physicians practicing in their communities could actually do as well as cancer center and university physicians in terms of the quality of care. And if whatever programs we put in place, they knew that there also had to be an evaluation component where we could demonstrate or at least measure that hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. And what was the
So the original program was called the CHOP, the Community Hospital Oncology Program. And then subsequently we did the CCOP, but we can get into that.
Okay. Tell me, what was the I suppose the, I don't know, it's a sort of a culture or attitude issue here of the this division in NCI, which is not known as a prevention but as a disease treatment area, and NIH being the same.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that that's true.
Okay.
I mean, NIH certainly in the Heart Institute has put a lot of resources into cardiovascular prevention. I mean, it comes across as treating high blood pressure or treating high cholesterol, but it's really prevention of heart attacks. Same with osteoporosis. We treat low, or study how to increase bone density. Nobody cares what your bone density is, only because it might lead to a fracture. So there really is, you know, subversive prevention going on. Problem with cancer is, you know, what do you treat? Atypical hyperplasia. You know, people kind of don't buy into that.
Well, was there much interest in treatment
going
NCI?
But going back to the 80s, it wasn't billed as a prevention program. I mean, originally, at least what we were doing in community oncology was more cancer control than outright primary prevention. It was making sure that physicians use the best, you know, practice the highest quality care, that that treatment benefits get diffused. It was all based on diffusion, that treatment benefits that we learned from clinical research get diffused into communities where patients are actually being seen. It had a big rehabilitation component also. It was the very early days of treating cancer like a chronic disease and having the means to do supportive care and symptom management.
Mm-hmm.
So prevention kind of was the subtext of building a network across the country. If you look at the first CCOP RFA, it specifically talks about funding community programs to participate in NCI-approved clinical trials for the purpose of diffusing best practices and building a network to do subsequent prevention clinical trials. And it wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s that we actually got into that.
And when you you then became chief of the community oncology and rehabilitation branch.
Yeah.
And what changes were taking place at that point in the mid-80s? Again, it's still Reagan.
Yeah, we went Reagan to Bush, severe budget cuts. But let me think back then. But and we had a large evaluation of the first phase of the CCOP program. It was, you know, kind of an overwhelming success. The numbers of patients going on trials was increasing, and so we didn't have too much trouble. And we had had this evaluation in place, so we didn't have too much trouble getting it funded a second time. The, you know, budgets were tight, but the science of, I mean, the research community was not nearly as politicized as it has been over the last 8 to 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, there weren't things like stem cells to worry about. I don't think Reagan was quite as much of an ideologue as some of the subsequent leadership. The NIH director was not nearly kind of as powerful as they've become. And I guess Bernadine Healy came in. She was a big supporter of what we were doing.
Okay.
So there really wasn't too much of an impact, if I remember correctly.
Explain the community clinical oncology program for me, what you were trying to accomplish.
Okay, so the first program we had when I first came in was called the Community Hospital Oncology Program, and that was based on this notion that if physicians in their communities develop best practices, develop guidelines, what we used to call them guidelines, I think they're back to calling them guidelines, you develop guidelines for how to care for certain cancers, that that will upgrade the quality of care, because all of the physicians in the community that have developed these consensus guidelines will follow them, and everything will be great. That evaluation demonstrated that these guidelines developed by community consensus usually were the lowest common denominator, and even if physicians followed them, they really didn't represent best practices. And so the CCOP program, Community Clinical Oncology Program, instead tied this notion of diffusing quality of care to clinical trials protocols, NIH, NCI-approved clinical trials that were done through our clinical cooperative groups. So pretty much the clinical trials or protocols were developed more by university physicians, cancer centers, and represented standard of care versus what we thought would be a better practice, the idea being that these kind of gold standards of practice would upgrade the quality of care, and that did prove to be more successful, and we were able to demonstrate that when there were positive results from clinical trials, that the community physicians who participated in the trials were more likely to pick up these new practices faster. And we never got to the point of measuring outcomes of patients, because that would have been too difficult and too long-term, but we did patterns of care studies and were able to demonstrate that physicians did adopt the new practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what about the nursing community?
We did have a program for nursing research. I mean, nurses were an integral part of doing any kind of clinical trials research. I mean, they're the primary support. And we also had a nursing research rehabilitation program. That was mainly through R01 research, though.
And was that later tied in with the NINR or as a collaborative thing or not really?
Only to the extent that they would sometimes have an RFA that they would want joint funding on if it had a cancer focus, or mm-hmm. or if we did an RFA that had a nursing focus, we would ask them to pick up a few grants. They actually didn't come into being until sometime in the 90s, I think. National Institute.
It became an institute in 93. It was a center on campus,
right,
in 86.
And one of our lead nurse researchers actually went over there to run their extramural program, so in the later 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we contributed.
Stolen or went, huh?
Stolen.
In these years, how were the agendas set within the division for what you wanted to do? For example, let me go back to the book that you did with Peter and on the goals for cancer goals for 1985 to 2000.
Oh, the goals for the year 2000.
Yeah.
It seems like ancient history. So I wrote the treatment chapter.
Uh-huh.
That again was all based on how we were going to the underpinnings were it was based on. The improvements in outcome were based on physicians practicing what we already knew was best care. And if everybody upgraded the quality of the care they provided to the standard of care, to the best state-of-the-art, that we used to call it state-of-the-art care,
mm-hmm.
then the modeling that they did demonstrated that you could get this amount of benefit to reduce mortality by the year 2000. So that's kind of the loop back. You know, how are we going to get physicians to actually upgrade the in practice state-of-the-art care, and that's where we had these different programs, the CHOP and the CCOP, all aimed at getting physicians to practice state-of-the-art care.
Was this book sort of the what you were writing in the different chapters, not just you, but the division the contributors to it, in setting those objectives, was that going to be the framework for
that was the
agenda?
Intention.
Yeah.
That was certainly the intention.
And what happened to the road to good intentions?
Wasn't that high up in the hierarchy at the time, but my impression was budgets and unrealistic expectations usually get in the way. Although I think there were things in that, like in the treatment chapter, we did institute programs that were aimed at addressing what was there. I can't even remember what was in the other chapters because I paid not much attention to them. There probably was one about screening. And there were a number of programs trying to get women to get mammograms. And we have the prostate, lung, colon, ovary trial that actually was conceived back in the late 80s. But I don't...
So the agenda for the division would change as other things occurred in terms of the...
Well, I mean, you have to
trials.
Take advantage of opportunities,
mm-hmm.
And I think the overriding agenda has always been the same: to decrease morbidity and mortality through an ordered sequence of research to applications. But you have to either go with the flow, take advantage of opportunities, pull back when budgets pull back. You know, reality kind of sets in.
Did Peter always set the standard for a public health presence, a public health initiative? That is, when I say that, it's public health in my view going beyond simply the research, and I can see this with community programs, but you came out of the public health. And I think others did as well in the leadership.
So we always kind of had this two-pronged approach where we would talk about interventions in the medical community,
mm-hmm.
and then interventions that were more public health related, like the smoking and the anti-smoking initiatives we did, the five-a-day, the diet initiatives, things that would aim at a broader application as opposed to medical interventions or clinical trials or things that related to activities in the medical community. I think we still view the activities that way. The thing is that a lot of the more public health activities have been taken over by the Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences. I mean, that was when we got that split, a lot of that went there.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that split. What was behind it?
What do I think was behind it? I think Dr. Klausner and Dr. Greenwald didn't see eye to eye on things, and so a committee was engineered. You know, we had a number of review committees, but there was a prevention committee, there was a cancer control committee, and a recommendation was forthcoming that the division should be split. I mean, there were a number of people that I knew that were in the room and refused to sign the reports, and it was, you know, clear that it had been engineered, that they were told, you know, the membership was selected as such, and they were told what they wanted in the reports.
And this was...
That was my recollection.
Mm-hmm. And this was really...
That they wanted to kind of make... That Peter had too much power over the entire cancer control budget, and that they... wanted to dethrone him.
So it's, like many things, it's a budget issue, money issue.
No, I think it was more a personality issue.
Ah, okay. And
because the money, I mean, the money was there. It was who controlled it and in whose likeness.
So the heart of the matter wasn't necessarily the where control belonged, but where the personalities.
Yeah, that's what I recall.
So it wasn't a scientific decision. It was a bureaucratic one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or power struggle. Peter was never a yes man.
You have worked with him a while.
Yeah. And, you know, he likes to stir up the pot. And so there are a few ways, you know, it's hard to fire him. So, you know, instead you take away some of the responsibility.
And what was the remaining office's reaction to all this? I mean, how do you put Humpty Dumpty back together?
Yeah. Well, we have, it's interesting, we have a kind of a core group of loyalists we say we have a passion for prevention on the prevention side, and we were able to rebuild the diet and nutrition group with brought in John Milner and things. So I mean, the division survived, and a lot of us, the people that were on, as I said, we had this kind of medical versus public health or two-pronged approach. The people, those of us that were on the medical side, which was the part that we kept, kind of thought the other was soft science anyway. And you know, so more power to them, let them go and do their community interventions and their surveys, and leave us to do the real work, you know, the real science.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've also noticed is that all the branch chiefs and the like are editors or service editors of the professional journals.
Yeah.
And
There have been more. I mean, and that's fairly recent. JNCI, of course, is the oldest of them, but the AACR journals, that's been a little bit more recent that we've been asked to serve on those.
When you say been asked to serve, who asked you to serve? Is that
the editors?
The outside editors.
Yeah.
But it also enables the office to keep a wise eye out for what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, when you review the articles and such, and I wondered if Peter had encouraged that, or is that just something that has happened? Because it seems to me rather new in the last 10 years.
Yeah, so I guess it started, you know, when Barry Kramer was here. He then became the editor-in-chief of the JNCI.
Mm-hmm.
So while, if I'm not mistaken, it was while he was still here.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of set the tone. I mean, obviously Peter allowed it, and that set the tone. He put a number of people from the division on the editorial board, and I guess it's been subsequent to that AACR first started their CEBP, whatever that stands for.
There are a lot of acronyms,
yeah,
I'm going to have to...
cancer, let's see, I have one. CEBP, Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. So that was really the first prevention-focused journal. A number, I guess Dave Alberts, who was one of our original grantees, was one of the editors of that. So he put, you know, we really were the experts in the field of cancer prevention. So he asked people to be on it, and now more recently AACR put out the Cancer Prevention Research Journal, and that is the editor-in-chief of that is Scott Littman, who was another one of our longtime grantees. And so he also asked people from the division to serve in various capacities on the journal. I mean, you know, this is where the expertise is, really. And maybe that's different than other fields, but the kind of the underpinnings for cancer prevention research really do lie here.
That is in
the Division of Cancer Prevention, I think so.
By in terms of selecting the extramural award.
Awardees? I mean in terms of, you know, kind of the knowledge base of cancer prevention research is very, very firmly in this division.
And that's no accident.
I don't think so. And you know, if you look around at who runs the directors of prevention and control at the various cancer centers, they probably all have, or a good many of them have come through this division either in our prevention fellowship program or you know, as actual employees of the division.
Who move back and forth, or
yeah.
You bring IPAs in, and
mm-hmm.
and so they have a chance to work here and then go back.
Yeah.
You also served on the Journal of Women's Health.
Yeah.
And they ask you to become the editor or an editor for that?
So I guess I'm on the editorial board.
That's what I mean,
yeah.
Editorial board.
And that goes back to, it's actually kind of two-pronged. That goes back originally to, that was, you know, the whole field of women's health research is only about 15 years old now, 20 years old. I guess I'm getting older. But but that goes back first to the advocacy for breast cancer research, and which spilled over into an advocacy for women's health research. The old line about you know, when they did research on women's diseases, they used mice, and not only that, they used male mice. You know, I'm sure you've heard that a
yes.
million times. It's probably not true, but it makes a good line. But that goes back. So when Bernadine Healy became NIH director, this was one of her platforms was to upgrade the quality of women's health research, and that's when the Women's Health Initiative was started. I was kind of involved in that from the breast cancer prevention side, and also in the division we had been doing a lot of the diet modification clinical trials with Carolyn Clifford that were the underpinnings of some of their interventions, their diet interventions. So I got involved back then, originally more from the breast cancer perspective, but then after Carolyn died, I took over her role in the WHI. So I've always been kind of on the tangentially on, you know, involved in the Women's Health Initiative, but also in the whole start of the wave of recognizing women's health research.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to some of these trials, which I believe you were in charge of, the breast cancer trial,
right.
Tamoxifen.
Mm-hmm.
And why did that come about?
So as I said, when we originally wrote the CCUP RFA, the first one, talked about doing treatment clinical trials in the community and building a network for eventual prevention clinical trials. And we had our network in place, and we also had data accumulating about tamoxifen. It was a drug that was used in the adjuvant setting for breast cancer, and we knew that it was relatively non-toxic. It wasn't a chemotherapy. It was a hormonal therapy, and that women who had early breast cancer and took it had a 50% decrease in their risk of getting a new cancer in their opposite breast, and so the timing seemed right. It was a pretty bold when we look back at it, to say, okay, we know this can do this in the adjuvant setting and with relatively healthy women. Maybe it's time to launch our first primary prevention trial in women that are at high risk for breast cancer. And Peter kind of gave me the ball and let me run with it. We put out a request. When we had this network, we had a system where we could implement a trial. And so we put out a request for through the cooperative groups, through our CCARP research bases, to submit concepts to do such a trial. We got two concepts, one for a full-blown trial, including pre- and postmenopausal women, and the other for a pilot study to see if it was feasible to do it. And we decided to just kind of barge right in and go with the full-scale trial. And as they like to talk about at NSABP, when we started, you know, he holds up the manual for how to do prevention clinical trials, and he says, when we started, this manual had no pages in it. So we really wrote the book on how to do cancer prevention clinical primary prevention clinical trials. It's been quite an interesting ride.
And when you identified, when you identified high-risk people, you were identifying from family?
There had been work done by Mitch Gale and other people in the Cancer Institute on risk factors for breast cancer, and they had developed a logistic regression model from old screening data that's now called the Gale model, because Mitch was the primary author on the paper. And it was actually the NSABP, the people that we selected to do the trial, that came up with the algorithm for how we would identify high-risk women. We said that this is when people were talking about a breast cancer epidemic, and the rates of breast cancer were just unacceptably high, and so they chose that they said that the risk of a 60-year-old woman. Now this was the lay press and everything else, that was just way too high. So we said, okay, if anyone has the risk of a 60-year-old woman, we'll consider that high risk. We had a way of measuring that based on known risk factors, you know, including family history and whether a woman had any children and things. And that now has kind of become the standard by which we talk about high risk for entering trials and for people considering interventions.
And what has the impact of genomic studies done on that?
So when we started the trials, the development phase was 90 to 92. We started accruing in 92. What was going on at the time in the breast cancer literature was there was the race to identify the breast cancer gene.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, and I guess I have to go back to the publication, but I think it was like 93 that it was sequenced. Might have been early 94, but I think it was 93, late 93. That was going to be the holy grail. Once we identified the breast cancer gene, we wouldn't need any of this because we would be able to tell who was at risk and who isn't, and then just concentrate on that group. And so we identified the breast cancer gene, and it took about 10 years to figure out what the function of the gene was. And since all the studies were done in these incredibly highly penetrant families, the estimates for how much this breast cancer gene or the mutation in the gene accounted for in the 100 or 200,000 odd cases of breast cancer that were diagnosed every year was way overestimated, way, way, way overestimated. So, you know, in the end, one does have a very high risk of developing breast cancer if you have one of these mutations, the attributable risk is fairly small, and the amount of breast cancer that it accounts for is fairly small. But that took a decade to figure out.
This is the BRAC
two? Yeah, the BRCA 1 and 2.
1 and 2, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there was this idea that that it would solve all of our problems in understanding breast cancer, but that hasn't, that has hardly happened. And when after we did the breast cancer prevention trial, we did do the study, the obligatory kind of, well, does it work in women that have mutation? And we did do mutation sequencing for all of our cases of breast cancer, and at Mary Claire King, who was the kind of the queen of the breast cancer gene, did it. The bottom line being that it accounted for, I think, 5 cases of breast cancer in the entire study. And BRCA1 happens to be a non-hormone-sensitive tumor, usually, so tamoxifen was probably not effective in that group. So what we thought was going to be the holy grail didn't exactly turn out that way.
And when you followed up with the STAR study, can you explain that and the relationship between that and drug companies for me?
Yeah, so the tamoxifen study, AstraZeneca was Zeneca at the time, was, mm-hmm. was pretty gutsy. They only gave us drug and placebo. They didn't, that still amounted to a substantial amount of money. They did not pay for any of the trial drug distribution or anything. But even, you know, making a statement by saying we'll allow our drug to be tested in a well population was pretty gutsy. The subsequent, congressional hearings, there was something called the Women's Health Network, who was financed by Ralph Nader and his Citizens in the Public Interest.
Research groups.
Yeah, Sidney Wolfe and Ralph Nader. There's a Women's Health Network that is part of that. Women's, I think that's what they're called. They were very much against the original tamoxifen trial, saying we were giving dangerous drugs to healthy women. They engineered congressional hearings, which is when Bernadine Healy and Peter and I bonded, sitting in front of a congressman for about 5 hours one day. So the trial really took on a way more controversial life than it should have. Then there were problems with data quality in another trial at NSABP, and Dingell got involved, and we had to shut down everything for a couple of months, but eventually finished it. AstraZeneca got dragged in about side effects that Dingell decided weren't fully disclosed, although anyone that read the consent form would have seen that they were. We had to re-consent everybody. It was anything that you've ever, read in history about what can go wrong with a clinical trial, short of Tuskegee and, actually ethical violations,
mm-hmm.
Got implicated in this trial. And believe me, it was all, everything was run perfectly, but when you get congressmen involved, that's what happens. Lots of lawsuits and counter lawsuits, and some people that got—let's just say Bernie Fisher got many millions of dollars in settlements. So that, to me, is a testament to how we were right and all these people were wrong. But anyway, so when we finished the tamoxifen trial, tamoxifen reduced risk by 50%. This other drug was coming along from Eli Lilly that had been approved for osteoporosis prevention and appeared to be safer than tamoxifen. There was some arm twisting because there was really nothing in it for AstraZeneca to put their drug up head-to-head with the Lilly drug, which we thought was going to be safer. But after some arm twisting, they agreed to. And it was also when the NIH was, when the NCI was pretty flush with money. It was during our doubling era. we had the mechanism set up, we had the machinery in place, and we just rolled from one trial into the other.
Same group?
Same group, yeah, mm-hmm. Same network. And this time with some pages filled in that empty book.
And, you including know, the ones at the end, How to Handle Congress?
Yeah, right. At the same time, we had then, you know, also capitalized on our experience, and so we had our whole prostate prevention enterprise going.
So these were running...
Simultaneously. Yeah.
And the,
so I was a pretty busy person.
Yeah. And the results of the STAR...
were that just what we anticipated, tamoxifen and raloxifene were equal in their breast prevention ability, but raloxifene was had less side effects, less uterine cancer, less thromboembolic events, mm-hmm. but could only be used in postmenopausal women, and tamoxifen was approved for pre and post.
And so... by then AstraZeneca?
Well, AstraZeneca, they went to the FDA. They, in 98, got the first approval for a drug to reduce the risk of breast cancer. And then Eli Lilly went, I guess it was in 2007, they got raloxifene approved for breast cancer risk reduction.
Okay. And then the prostate cancer, that run into problems as well, that study?
So that one actually ran very smoothly. It was when we saw the results that this is the power of editorial writers. The results showed that there was what appeared to be a slight increase in, although finasteride reduced the risk of prostate cancer by 25%, which was what we were aiming for. That was the hypothesis. There was a 1.6% increase in high-grade, appeared to be high-grade tumors that were diagnosed in men on finasteride. So less tumors overall, but higher number of tumors that were high-grade, and that kind of drove the whole discussion that the editorial writer said it was only preventing non-significant tumors and shouldn't, essentially said it shouldn't be used. And the company, this was Merck. Mm-hmm. This happened within... let's see, the article was published in July, and over the summer there were discussions about, you know, should they go for FDA approval or not. This was also the drug they sold as Propecia for hair loss. So it had implications beyond just the prostate indication, prostate prevention indication. And by September they were withdrawing Vioxx from the market because of unexpected cardiovascular toxicities, and there was no way they were going to risk anything, any other blockbuster products that they had before the FDA because of unanticipated side effects. So Merck didn't, I mean, this is my interpretation of the timeline. So they really had no interest in going for a prostate prevention indication while the question of potential high-grade tumors was still around.
And has...
Subsequently, so that was 2003, 2004. Subsequently, we've done a lot more research on the tumors and the prostates, and re-reviewing every single slide, every single prostatectomy, and... it appears that the explanation is has more to do with bias related to finasteride shrinking the prostate, and so if there is a high-grade tumor, you're more likely to hit it, and then it is a real biologic phenomena. I mean, there have been, I think, 3 or 4 papers published just in the last 6 months, some modeling, some based on actual data comparing the pathology specimens, that all come down to this conclusion. So there's been talk again about should we go back to the FDA and try and get an indication.
Mm-hmm. And then the other is the SELECT study.
Right.
A little different. Tell me about...
So that one done with the active phase of the... So we started planning SELECT back in 2000. It was a very long planning period. I mean, the finasteride study was totally accrued but not reported.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about what do we do next in prostate cancer, and we were faced with these two secondary analyses, one from the alpha tocopherol trial that was done in Finland. That showed that vitamin E appeared as a second. So we had, you know, those large beta carotene studies that showed that beta carotene increased the risk of lung cancer in smokers rather than the opposite effect. But in the Finland study, there was vitamin E that appeared to decrease the risk of prostate cancer, and then there was another large selenium study done in Arizona. Clark was the PI that was directed at skin cancer, didn't decrease skin cancer, but again showed a decrease in prostate cancer. And plus a lot of animal data and other epidemiologic studies, and we went back and forth and decided that, you know, rather than pharmaceuticals, it probably would be, and since so many people take supplements, it would be nice to know what these supplements do. And after a very long gestational period, I think it was about three years of planning and discussion and expert committees and what form of selenium and what dose of vitamin E, and we actually launched the study, which involved 35,000 men, which accrued in record time in under 3 years. I think just a little over 3 years. We had planned for a 5-year accrual period. And we're pretty disappointed, I guess it's like 3 months ago now, 4 months ago, to hear from the Data Monitoring Committee that there was absolutely no effect of any of the agents, and they recommended that we stop study supplementation.
Mm-hmm. What took so long for the planning?
Are these secondary hypotheses strong enough that we should launch something this big and this expensive?
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the, so selenium is selenium, but there's selenized yeast, there's selenomethionine, there's a number of different preparations that are sold as selenium. And there was a big question about which was the one that was the most bioavailable, which was the one that could potentially be the most active. What did Clark use in his study? We had to go back and analyze his pills. And so that was about, I'd say, a year process. There was also similar questions about vitamin E. In the Finland study, it was 50 milligrams. We were proposing to use 400. Is that a safe dose? There were cardiovascular studies going on that, because vitamin E was also implicated as, you know, you needed to take it for cardiovascular health. Would we ever be able to continue the study once the results of the cardiovascular studies came out and vitamin E, you know, was so wonderful and would be taken by everybody? As it turned out, it not only wasn't wonderful, it was detrimental in the cardiovascular studies. So that problem got off the table. Then we had to make sure men knew that what they were taking wasn't going to harm them. But it just, it's, you know, when you're making an investment of $100 million and involving 35,000 men, there was the, you know, writing the protocol, the peer review.
Mm-hmm.
So it just, takes a long time. At one point, Dr. Coltman, who was the head of the Southwest Oncology Group that was sponsoring the study, we had one of our meetings with selenium experts to come up with a consensus of what formulation we should use, and the vote was split, and he famously said, "I am not embarking on a $100 million venture on a split vote." And so we, you know, kind of went back to the drawing boards and came up with a design that people could unanimously endorse. But that all takes time.
Yeah, it does. Huh. Over the years, what changes would you tell me about in the division? What do you think are the significant changes?
Well, some of the personnel changes, I think, were you know, kind of in a detrimental sense. I mean, Ed Sondak was really one of the pillars of the division back in its early days.
Mm-hmm.
And during the whole, the 94, during the what we call the debacle, and Sam Broder subsequently leaving, and Ed then became acting NCI director, and then went to National Center for Health Statistics. I think that was a major loss, both to the division and probably to the cancer community. I mean, he was just such a good thinker. You know, he wasn't trained in cancer. He was a biostatistician, operations research person, but just a wonderful mind. And I think that hurt the division. If you go back even further, and Peter probably talked about this, I was not involved in that side of it, but our first deputy director was Joe Cullen. He was the architect of all of our smoking research or anti-smoking research. And I think when he left, that was a blow to the division. That's some of the stuff that's now in Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, not to, I know I'm being taped, but Peter is tends, his management style tends to, he's engaged at some times and not engaged at others, and that's kind of difficult over the years.
what accounts for the ebb and flow?
I'm not sure. How well he's getting along with the NCI director.
Well, that. Yeah.
Yes. How many grandchildren he has.
Well, I've certainly heard both stories.
Yeah, right. I mean, we've always been, you know, this goes back to your first question about a prevention division in a traditionally treatment-oriented environment. Even if, you know, I say that cardiovascular and other places do prevention research, they don't really have divisions of prevention. And so we've always been somewhat of a stepchild. And, you know, really Peter, when he came in the 80s, was building the field from absolute nothing. Really from scratch. People thought of prevention as vaccines. We've come full circle now with a cervical vaccine, but back then they didn't understand what it meant to reduce your risk or to prevent, you know, how could you possibly prevent cancer? So it's been a PR struggle, and it's you know, we haven't always been the most popular kids on the block. And I think since, actually, Harold Varmus and Rick Klausner, I think, were very supportive, and they kind of put their money where their mouth was. They both, when we had the press conference to announce the results of the first breast prevention trial, they both came and spoke. David Satcher, who was the Surgeon General at the time, at a congressional hearing, compared it to the discovery of smallpox vaccine, you know, in terms of how really significant the findings were, and compare that to fast forward to the finasteride announcement, 25% reduction in prostate cancer, and our NCI director at the time, Andy Van Eschenbach, didn't quote, "I don't like the trial," and refused or had a competing engagement when we had the press conference to announce those results.
If Klausner was such a supporter, why did he split the...
He was a supporter of the concept, but not
because
Peter frustrated him.
But not the concept-y, huh?
Yeah, because Peter frustrated him terribly.
Okay. and relation with Varmus?
Or
better?
I think so, yeah.
And what what do you would you say would be the great success of the division over the years? What would stick out in your minds?
Well, certainly the first, all of the prevention trials, but the first one, I mean, to actually bring to get a drug approved for risk reduction in cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the greatest disappointment is that it hasn't been adopted more widely, and that's partly our fault for the Cancer Institute, not mine, but the Cancer Institute's fault in not having a communications plan and really the backbone to kind of go out there and promote the idea of cancer prevention. You know, when you hear about cancer prevention, you think of screening. So that would be one. And I really think the next generation of scientists that we've trained, I mean, every cancer center now, whether they're functional or not, has a director of cancer prevention and control. And 20 years ago, that wasn't part of the cancer center criteria for comprehensiveness, and it just was given lip service. And now there are real research portfolios. MD Anderson has a huge cancer prevention building and the largest endowment of any of their programs. The person that used to be here, Ernie Hawk, is the VP for cancer prevention at MD Anderson. I mean, those are huge statements about the viability of the field.
And you said, I'm sorry, Andy Anderson or MD?
MD Anderson, the cancer center in Houston.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And other cancer centers have major cancer prevention programs. Probably the biggest disappointment has been that the pharmaceutical industry has not bought into the concept. They haven't figured out that it actually could be profitable to develop drugs for that could prevent cancer, like it's profitable to develop drugs that prevent heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really been, you know, and all these committees and suggestions about giving them extended patent life and stuff have not grabbed on in Congress, because Congress, of course, has the mindset that drug companies charge too much and make too much money anyway. So it's hard to reconcile that with there's no incentive to develop drugs for prevention, because it takes so long in the development process that by the time they're done, they're off patent. That's been a struggle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the tamoxifen and the Eli Lilly.
I mean, their uptake, you know, the increase in sales based on their approvals hasn't been enough to spur the industry.
Further work in the area.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would assume it's hard for a division to carry that water. As
right,
opposed
you know,
to the
we,
whole NCI.
Right, and we have an agent development group. We can develop agents and do small scale studies, but you need pharmaceutical partners for any serious definitive phase 3 trials.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much. Is there anything we haven't covered? Let me that you'd like to talk about.
I don't think so. I'm sure you talked to Lori, right?
Yes.
You talked to Lori and you talked to Eva, so they gave you the... You did talk to Eva?
No.
No. Did you talk to anyone from the organ systems group?
No, I don't think so, no. Let me look at my... The answer is I'm pretty sure not.
Okay.
Nutrition. I talked to John. I talked to Barry Kramer. Vern Steele. Laura.
Okay. So Vern does the agent development, the
right.
Preclinical.
But no organ.
Yeah. So I guess just to kind of fill in the one missing piece, which is our early phase program. So after I did all these large phase 3 trials, and we had a kind of flood, we had agent development. Vern's been in that group for a very long time. But we kind of had a missing link of how do we develop these agents in the smaller scale phase 1 and 2 trials. And also how do we develop organ expertise. And as a result of one of our retreats, we decided to reorganize into what we call the matrix organization. Never was really quite a matrix organization, but as a result, we did develop organ expertise in 4 organ site groups who would be responsible for the early phase research taking from preclinical into human studies, any of the agents that became available, trying to capitalize on the molecular targets that were starting to emerge and the pathways so that it was more than just taking from, you know, a secondary endpoint from a treatment trial and saying now we'll try it in prevention, but really trying to start earlier in the process. We know this is the pathway that's involved or the target of an agent. And so we developed these 4 organ systems groups, lung, GI, GU, or prostate, and breast and gynecologic cancers. And I, Lori became the chief of the community oncology and prevention trials group. It was community oncology.
I'm sorry, Roy?
Lori, who you talked to, Lori Manazzi.
Oh, Lori, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I took over as kind of the associate director for clinical research, so I still oversaw that at a higher level, but also organizing the these organ groups. And we developed a contract mechanism with 6 consortiums to do paralleled after the Division of Cancer Treatments program for doing early phase trials, where these consortium would submit letters of intent to develop, do phase 1 and 2 trials, either solicited if they were agents that we had available or compounds or ones that they could get or were developing in their own centers. So that's kind of now one of the cornerstones of our prevention program.
Mm-hmm.
is these consortiums. They're going to have to be recompeted in the next year or so, but they, after some growing pains, have been fairly successful in doing early stage biomarker endpoint studies, but points out again the lack of participation by the pharmaceutical industry in giving us agents to test.
Mm-hmm. So they're all done in the clinical centers.
Yeah, our consortium, we have contracts with Arizona, University of Arizona Cancer Center, Irvine, Northwestern, MD Anderson, Mayo
mm-hmm.
Clinic
mm-hmm.
in Rochester, and you never remember all of them. Oh, University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they each have their own little networks. So it's been another way of kind of getting our tentacles out in the field. It's the enthusiasm and the camaraderie has really grown. I'd say this has been about 5 years that we've been in the field, and so again, it's a matter of training a new generation of investigators, of medical oncologists and others that are comfortable with the notion of cancer prevention research and really the concept that you can prevent cancer.
Tell me about the retreats. Your annual, semi-annual?
Well, when we were flush, they were quite the affair. You know, we had entire division retreats at real retreat places out in, I guess if it wasn't West Virginia, it was close to West Virginia, and in Leesburg, and where we were wined and dined. They've gotten a little more minimal over the last 2 years. They would build camaraderie. We'd come out with all these plans, goals, mission statements, vision statements. Never seen, and I'm not a big retreat and strategic planning type person, so probably a lot of it is my fault that there was a lot of enthusiasm, and then things would kind of fall. The air was out of the balloon, and business went kind of back to usual, but never quite as far back as before we had them.
Mm-hmm. And these are an annual thing?
I guess they were. I mean, it wasn't like it's time for our annual retreat, but probably the way it fell out, they were about annual.
It's time to get together and
sort
of and then restart the engines.
Yeah, in the interim, we would have smaller retreats with just the leadership, the group chiefs, and we haven't had a full division retreat in quite a while. We did have a leadership retreat last month.
So I wonder why they call it retreats when you really want to go forward.
Right now.
I have to think about that one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation, and it's been very helpful.
Okay, good.
And if I may, need additional information,
Sure.
Okay to call you back?
Yeah, absolutely.
Terrific.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.